Chief Lee Bakken, you wanna come visit with us? Oops, what happened? Where did it all go?
Good evening.
There it goes.
I'm here for our fourth quarter report for 2011. The fourth quarter brought 32 alarms to the city of Othello. One of those alarms being Simplot Foods. And they had a fire in an MCC room out there, which is an electrical room. And it did interrupt their production for a short period of time. They were able to get back online by some other means in the plant. That was our probably most significant fire for the fourth quarter. The staff had 5 trainings. 24 commercial business inspections were completed, not including the re-inspections. Once we do a inspection, if there's any deficiency found, our inspector goes back for a re-inspection. And we don't include those in the stats. 2011, as a year in all, 119 fire calls or emergency calls. That was up just a slight from the 215 for the previous year. 35 trainings were completed by staff personnel and personnel, one of those being the Walla Walla flashover trailer. And we bring that up every other year and run our firefighters through it. What that is it's a semi-trailer that has live fire actually built into it. Our firefighters can go in and attack a gas-fed fire. They feel the heat, they react to the fire. The trainers can actually light up different props throughout the trailer. You can crawl in, go after a simulated stove fire, and he'll light a bed up behind you. It's a very intriguing to participate in. I mean, it's a great training. We can't offer it in any other situation where it's so well maintained and safe for our people to go in. And then they've added props to it as far as getting out of the building for firefighters' safety. We can rappel off the side of it. We can come down a ladder, both head first or feet first. We could drop through a floor, simulate a wall, and we drop through it with a pack on, different things like that. Our firefighters respond well to it. They enjoy the flashover trailer. So, our fire prevention program. In October each year, we go to the schools and do a fire prevention program. We've got a robotic fire plug that goes in and talks to the kids. And this year we saw just over 1,000 kids in the Othello schools. And that includes the Mid-Columbia Christian and a few daycares and preschools that want us to come in and talk. The past 2 years we've been seeing the Royal City and Warden schools come to Othello and tour. I believe they're touring the police department, the hospital, and the fire department when they come over. And we always do a little fire prevention in our presentation to them as well. The some of our summertime projects were our annual testing of the fire pumps on both the engines and the aerials. Everything passed. No deficiencies there. Ground ladder testing. We actually have a mobile testing lab or unit come in and they weight test our ladders to make sure they're safe for firefighters. We had a couple that needed some repairs, some minor repairs. Those were done in-house. We had one that has a bend in it that was there before the testing, and we've just taken it out of service. It wasn't on a first run engine or anything. So we had a backup ladder that we replaced it with. And then again, we teamed with Public Works for our annual hydrant testing. They tested 110 hydrants, and I think off the top of my head, I think there was approximately 20 that needed some attention, and Public Works, I'm sure, is working on that or has completed that. that's a project that needs to be continued. That helps with our surveying rating. And Washington Surveying Rating did inform us in August that they would be here last year. They arrived in January, and Kelly McRogan with Surveying Rating spent 2 days here in Othello. They go over all the district or fire department operations, training, fire prevention, fire inspections, the whole gambit. They go through the records and reports and check everything. They go through the city water system. They look at the hydrants, the flows, the storage capabilities, everything there. They even came up and visited the police department because we're dispatched here. So it's a very in-depth audit that she came in and did. She takes all that information, goes back home, and now it's time for her to put it all together and do a rating of the city and the district. And what that does is that is a rating for insurance companies. They know what the fire department can provide for their customers and how to classify their customers as far as their policies. So looking forward to those results. Once I get them, the city will have a copy. The Mike just put up on the screen, our average response time for 2011 was 4 minutes and 35 seconds. Got a little bit quicker this year because we weren't dealing with some of the issues we dealt with last year, the road construction, either on Broadway or on Main Street. We got over that and our times got a little bit quicker. Realistically, I would like to maintain that right around the 4:30 mark. If we could, it was 4:15, but that's a pretty quick time for a volunteer base. Mike, if you could go back to that next report, please. Yes. That's a summary of the incidents. That's 119 calls broken down into fire, rescue, emergency calls. It does include medical in the title, but we don't do medical. Rescue will be more or less a auto accident that we respond to, whether we're responding to aid the ambulance or to do extrication. Then the next one down is hazardous conditions, and that can range from a gas leak to a gas spill, electrical hazards, things like that. Service calls, we don't do cats out of trees, but we do other things. So people always ask that. Good intent, somebody smells smoke, sees smoke, gives us a call. We'd rather go investigate when someone smells it rather than when someone sees it. So earlier we can get there, the better off we are. False alarms. False alarms is the biggest percentage of our calls, 55% basically. And these are all the way from the residential fire alarms to the commercial fire alarms now that we're responding to. It takes a lot of time for us, but fire alarms do work. They save lives, save property. And then the final one, the spatial incident type, which I didn't look that one up. That could be a cat. But in a nutshell, that's 2011. Do you have any questions?
Any questions? Well, I do. The fire alarm, so the industrial, or so the citizens' fire alarms and business fire alarms are attached to the fire department?
They're attached to a central station, monitoring station, like ADT.
Oh, okay.
Or Simplex has a monitoring system. Walmart has their own for all their stores, things like that. But Yes, they need to be attached to a central station, so they're monitored 24 hours a day.
So if, let's say, a business repeatedly does 30 alarms in 1 year, is there a penalty you put towards a business for not correcting, or you just try to work through it?
Well, before they hit 30, we're talking with them.
Oh, okay.
And they're not liking us to show up and disturb their business either. A fire alarm, say, in any business, whether it be Evergreen or CBHA or the hospital per se, it interrupts your business. You have incentive to repair the alarm system to prevent the false alarms. So there is incentive there for them to do it. There's no monetary fees or fines yet for that. I'm reluctant to try to impose any type of fee for that right now. I would rather they be monitored and monitored and working correctly than they try to disconnect the alarm system or something like that.
No questions from council? Well, we want to thank you and the fire department. So, Eamon, you had something?
Just back to the fire rating. It's very important for this community to have the best rating possible. And I remember right, we have the best rating we can get without a full-time fire department. Is that right?
Possibly. I want to hear that from them. I want to know what we can do to improve before.
Sure.
Before I answer that, I'm hoping that we're a, last time we were rated a 5, we were rated 4 points under going to a 6. The more points you have are the more deficiencies you have. So we were 4 points away from a 6 rating. I'm confident that we will be well under that this time because of the programs that we've established now, because of our staff and our equipment, and the joint between the contract, because we've got twice the equipment we've ever had before. The last survey that was actually done here in Othello was 1990. There's been some verbal updates, but nothing to the extent of this year we've seen.
So, thanks.
Well, thanks again. We appreciate
the
relationship we have. It sure works real well for both of us. Okay, 2.01, Adams, oops, that's where I'm at. 2.02, Comprehensive Plan Review, Vision Statement, Housing Element, and Land Use. Daryl.
Good evening, Mayor, members of the council. For the record, Daryl Piercy, City Planner. We're here again before you this evening to talk about three sections of the draft comprehensive plan, and hopefully we'll get some closure on these three so we can move forward into the next phase of goals and policies in the plan, which deal with capital facilities and utilities. And the capital facilities plan especially becomes very important in terms of things like you just heard in regard to level of service standards, the response time for police and fire and those things. So it'll be exciting to kind of get into some of those policies and really work with staff to identify what the expected level of service is in the city and then begin to establish ways in which we can meet that. But before we get there, we need to make sure that everyone this evening is comfortable with the City of Othello Community Vision Statement, which is really the opening message of the comprehensive plan, that if somebody were to pick up the book, that's what they're going to see first. And so we want to make sure that this is reflects the major, very broad concepts that the city operates under. These aren't intended to necessarily narrow in on any specific element of the comprehensive plan, but sort of set that tone for the real direction that the city wants to go. And you can see that they're very general items in each of those bullet points, but nevertheless, it really does help to set the tone and the feel, if you will, of the comprehensive plan as somebody opens up that book and gets a sense of what the City of Othello is really striving for. So I'm hopeful that you've had a chance in the last three meetings to look through these and talk amongst yourself and with members of the community, and if there's any changes before we move on, I'd be happy to listen to what the council would like to input into this document And once we do that, we can consider this issue closed and move on to the next. So any feedback or comments on the vision statement?
The last paragraph of the City of Ophelia is a community that supports and promotes the development of light industrial uses. What do you classify as light industrial uses?
Well, it really points to our code. In this particular instance, it probably tends to focus more on developments such as business parks, non-manufacturing uses, and uses that don't necessarily fit that heavy manufacturing role. We're not making automobiles in Othello. We're primarily making produce, manufacturing of produce, selling and repairing implements, supporting the agriculture business, and promoting business development in general. And that tends to be what that is saying. But if you'd like to that just say industrial so we can be more inclusive of a broader range of uses, that would also make sense.
I would like to strike that word light.
So get light out of there and just talk about industrial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Good comment. Anything else?
Doesn't look like it.
Okay. Well, we'll consider that one, put the rest for right now. You will have an opportunity before we adopt the comprehensive plan to come back and revisit any of these elements, but it's good to kind of go through these one by one and get some buy-in for those. So the next is goals and policies regarding land use. This one's a little more involved and covers several pages. It deals both with residential land use issues. It deals with commercial land use, industrial land use, and also land use issues involving critical areas. You may recall, been almost 3 years ago now, time flies, that you adopted a critical areas ordinance for the city that was compliant with the state requirements for that. And so we have a very fresh, compliant critical areas ordinance. And the goals and policies that are in that critical areas section really reflect the most recently adopted critical areas ordinance that you have. So that's really almost a rehash of the policies that were found in that document. But the rest are ones that bring your comprehensive plan kind of up to date in today's world and address the issues in terms of what's important for residential and commercial and industrial development.
How would you like to proceed, Council? You want him to go through the land use and then the housing goals, or just sort of scan down at it, or everybody had a chance to read it and things like that? You want to start at the land use one, Mike? I guess we'll just sort of scan down it page by page by page.
Okay, and I can just make a kind of an overview, too. In general, in the residential area, what we're suggesting is that we provide reasonable levels of land that would accommodate future housing needs, that would encourage the housing development to locate and cluster within the city limits or the urban growth area, and look for urban levels of development rather than rural levels of development, because it's much more efficient to provide urban services to 4 units per acre than it is for 1 unit per 5 acres. It's very difficult to finance that sparse of development. So the idea is to create a city setting rather than a rural setting, because we are within the city limits. There are provisions for encouraging a variety of housing choices, whether it be a single family fairly expensive to single family modest or less expensive to multifamily housing and everything in between. So there is a desire to have a wide variety and a mix of housing stock to fit all of the needs of the community. One of the keys, I think, is as we get later into the housing policies, is this idea that there is a relationship from development to development, and that when we look at a individual development, we should look at its relationship to either existing development or anticipated future development. And I think this reflects to a large degree what has actually occurred up in the Sagestone development, where you have roads planned for future connections, where typically you don't have a disconnect from one development to the next. As we move forward, for instance, with development in that area, you're going to see extension of roadways, you're going to see extension of utilities, extension of other services that the city offers and provides in a thought-out, well-planned way. And the policies here would encourage more of that type of development that considers its neighbors, not just treating development as a island within a community of other houses. So I think that's an important element of that residential area as well. In the commercial policies, this really is intended to identify and support the city's commitment to having a vibrant and active business community within the city of Othello, and setting forth policies that will provide for that opportunity for small business development, development that comes from within the residents of the city, and one that promotes economic development and job creation. So I think the goals that are established within the commercial development reflect, well, at least what the Planning Commission and I have heard as a real major goal for the city of Othello is to promote those local-based jobs and services and retail establishments that provide service back to the community.
Darrell, one thing under that commercial there, change that wording on that goals and policies on that first portion. Just a little quirk of mine. I don't think you're on policies, I think it's policies.
Yeah, I believe you're right.
I did read some of it.
My finger must have gotten a little twitch there on the L. Under industrial lands, again, the idea is to encourage and promote the development of local industry and to allow for job creation and the opportunity for citizens that living within Othello to have jobs locally and to be able not having to travel for miles and miles and commute for great distances to find employment, but rather to have employment here and provide opportunities and land area that specifically is set aside for this type of development and for these types of jobs that could be created in the community. There is a section on mixed-use developments which deal with the incorporation of businesses and residences and planned communities where you might have apartment buildings and small retail shops, those sort of things. That is a planning tool that is being utilized in a lot of communities, big and small, that seems to have some pent-up demand within the city of Othello. We get inquiries quite regularly about the ability to conduct businesses, either conduct a business and have an apartment or some other housing area with it, or in some way create a community that has this mixed use potential or opportunity. And while I think it's important that those be handled carefully and well thought out and well planned, these policies at least provide some opportunity to be able to do that. And as we get into a update of our zoning code, if these policies are adopted, our zoning code would reflect the ability to meet these goals and policies by offering mixed-use development as well.
Excuse me, Darrell. Eugene had a question for you.
Now, you'll go through and change, because I'm noticing this light industrial a lot through here.
We'll change light to industrial. Yeah, okay. Just do a word search and get that out.
All right.
And then finally, under critical areas, as I said, that really reflects the critical areas ordinance that was recently updated and adopted by the city that's compliant with state law, and these policies and goals simply reflect the elements that were adopted as part of that critical areas ordinance. Interesting to note, there is not a significant issue with critical areas within the city of Othello, so while these all meet requirements of state law, it isn't something that we have to effectively deal with on a day-to-day basis when dealing with permits or other planning issues. So it's good to have. If Othello expands into areas where this may come into play more frequently, we have the policies in place, but other than that, it isn't something that we really are affected by on a day-to-day basis within our current boundaries. So changing and correcting the spelling on policies and removing light from industrial, are there any other issues or comments or concerns that the council has in regards to the land use policies?
I got one more here, Darrell. I don't know how our code is for sure. I haven't read everything, kept up on it, but we've got a couple things in here on land use 210. You've got a situation in here where we're talking about, let's say, an apartment or a house for a relative or something in an area, and I thought we more or less stopped that portion of things. And I see that it's we've got a portion in here. I don't know where we're going with it. I guess is what I'm asking.
This particular policy reflects language from Washington state law. Now, just so you are aware, in general terms, Washington state law requires that cities provide for accessory dwelling units and allow for those within their zoning code, with the exception of cities that fall under a certain population range. And the city of Othello falls under that range. So you are not obligated under state law to have provisions in your zoning code to allow accessory rental structures that are being described here. So those policies meet the intent of the law, but you're not required to do that. So if you wanted to remove those, you could. It's becoming very common to have those available simply because they provide an additional level of affordable housing within your community. And it does meet a certain population that is underserved in terms of housing stock currently. So, but the decision is completely up to you in terms of whether or not that's something that you want to continue to have outside of your zoning code. And if you did, we'd want to remove that policy.
Okay. Yep. Dan, what are the parameters of that? And I mean, are we talking about a bedroom that somebody rents out to somebody, or a mother-in-law apartment that you have at the back of the house that's set up as a little kitchen, living room, and a bedroom?
All of the above. Boarding houses, which would be the bedroom inside an existing residence, or an accessory dwelling unit, which might be that small apartment out back. All of those could be considered part of this element. One of the things, like anything else, what really comes down to is here's your policy, but what are the regulations to implement that policy? And within the zoning code, if that's something you wanted to pursue, the zoning code would have to have some very, I think, well-defined guidelines, both in terms of lot size and relationship to neighboring properties and potential impacts on neighboring properties. At the very least, I would see that any use of that nature would be a conditional use, so that you would have an opportunity to examine each individual case to determine whether or not there was a significant impact to adjacent properties and whether or not it made sense in that particular location. But that's really where those kinds of regulations would take place in your zoning code. This sets the general policy that says, yes, if they're compatible, if we can find ways to make them work, we would allow those, but it would be dependent upon the regulations that the city adopts.
Thank you.
So like if somebody wanted to move in a 15-foot trailer they bought, park it there and put power to it, and away they go? Or
that would not be allowed.
That would not be allowed.
For a whole host of reasons, not the least of which, a travel trailer is not intended to serve as a permanent residence, and our code already prohibits that.
That's what I thought, yeah.
Okay.
I had another one here, too. I can't find it right now, but it was in relation to manufactured homes. Somewhere in there, I think it said any place in a residential area.
And that is consistent with state law. We actually are required to allow manufactured homes anywhere where you can allow a stick-built single-family structure. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't put certain requirements and restrictions on the type of manufactured home that you allow within your city. And, in fact, you do. Under your code, manufactured homes are allowed, but they have to meet certain architectural designs. The pitch of the roof, for example, has to be a certain pitch, more like a residential structure. I believe it has to have an attached garage, and the electrical meter needs to be internal of that. So usually if you're placing a manufactured home to meet those requirements, your electrical meter and meter box are inside your garage. So you don't have this pedestal like you might typically find for a mobile home park that has an external power source that's brought to the unit. Oddly enough, there are some hose bib requirements, because there's a certain way to do hose bibs that are consistent with stick-built homes, but you don't necessarily always find them on manufactured homes, so they have to be special order to meet that requirement. And then there's some other siding and other aesthetic issues that are required in your code to help the manufactured home blend in more with the community and other stick-built homes. But under state law, you can't restrict manufactured homes from those residential areas where stick-built structures are allowed. Now, that said, developments can restrict those. If there's a covenant within a plat or a development that says no manufactured homes or no modular homes or no one-story homes, whatever that covenant wants to say, you can do that within the confines of a homeowners association, but the city does not enforce those.
Comment, Mayor?
Go ahead.
Ken, you bring up a good point. The manufactured home in a residential area next to a stick-built home has been an issue at the state legislature for 30 years that I know of. I remember fighting this 30 years ago. However, as Daryl has explained, there are conditions and standards that we can impose that would basically make them like a stick-built home. So we as a city can take some corrective action, but you cannot prohibit them. The manufacturing home industry has a very, very strong lobbyist group in Olympia. A guy named Chuck Mize is a head of that, and he's very successful in fighting city after city that imposes a prohibition. I've seen him destroy several cities' ordinances that have prohibited him, and it goes to the state legislature to get some change, basically. So it's a long-standing fight. It's a good question. It reduces, in some people's minds, adjacent property values. That is an argument, but right now the state state law says you can. That was a good answer, Darrell.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments?
Well, the next element.
Let's go one more here.
Okay.
I see in here too. I can't give you the exact page, but I know. In here, when we're talking about commercial, and then and we're also talking about a residential above that commercial, like we do on Main Street, say you got a business down below, and say you got three stories above it is residential. Well, my understanding, present time, we basically can't do that, but it is in here. Now, is that under a code again, as far as the size of the city or the population, or?
Well, there's no requirement under state code, but I think in general, you have a business community that probably would support that to some degree, because it offers two things, I think, for the business community that we don't offer currently. One is the ability for a small business owner to be connected to their shop in some way, shop down below, living above it. Barber shop, I think, comes to mind. I can think of a couple as I was growing up where that occurred, where there was a restaurant that we had in town where I grew up, where the owners lived above the restaurant. And so there's a connection there to the downtown core, to their business. The other is that you can have the commercial development at the ground floor, but typically commercial developments on second and third floors in a small town or small city generally do not do well. So you lose a whole opportunity for revenue generation above the first floor. By offering the opportunity of some residential development above that first floor of commercial, you enhance the economic viability of a particular piece of property for that business owner, so that perhaps in startup or some lean times, he'll have the income from the residential use to offset maybe some of the commercial activity. So from an economic sense, there's an incentive for the property owner to maximize the value of the land.
Yeah, I think it's something we need to look at. I mean, sure, fine, we're well with what we've got now, but a lot of times you go ahead and build a commercial building, you'd like to have something above that. And a lot of areas, if you've got a confined area, which we don't have as far as a confined downtown, I guess you'd say, that people like to be close to that particular area, and that's why they like to have that residence above commercial areas as well. And also it works well as having people that doesn't necessarily have to be on the street every day as far as their business, but also for offices or whatever that they can use for that same purpose. So I think it's probably a good idea that someday we'll have to come to something like that. So.
The other thing that has kind of been shown too is by having some sort of residential activity involved mixed with your business community, there's less opportunity for crimes in your central business area because it isn't abandoned after 5 o'clock. There's people there, eyes and ears, if you will, and so there's some benefit to that as well. And I think those communities that have that mixed development opportunity report success in that regard. So it's something that we can look at. Again, it's one of those issues that it really comes down to how do you regulate it and what are the implications in the zoning code in terms of actually applying it. And so that's something that we'll want to take a good look at when we get to that level if you want to maintain at least the general policies that would support it in the comprehensive plan.
If my memory serves me, there's a couple of places like that in town, or have been. Down on the corner of Broadway and Scutney, I think what used to be Labby Mint, if anybody remembers that. There was a really nice apartment upstairs there, three bedroom, two bath, okay. That went up stairway in the back.
I think you actually have a couple down on First too, that have been pretty well established for quite some time. One has recently been remodeled, so it looks pretty nice. But so there are some examples of that, and we do get inquiries. I think we had two inquiries this week about the possibility of opening an office with a residence above it. And in this particular case today, what the inquiry we had, the house was in a neighborhood, so a residential neighborhood, so that wouldn't work. But had he been located in a commercial zone, he was looking for that very opportunity of having a business located downstairs with his residence above.
Any other questions? It's really important for all of us on the council to make sure we read these. Like Ken's come up with these good questions, all of you. What we're doing right now is probably a 15-20 year plan we're putting together.
20-year plan.
Yep. Okay. So it's important we take a good look at this as we're going and have questions like we're hitting. That's real healthy. So.
And again,
setting our future.
This won't be your last opportunity, but it'll be the first. It'll be the last time we focus specifically on these, this element. And then the next one dovetails pretty nicely into this. It's the housing goals and policies. It really helps support what we just established in land use and now specifically applies it to housing. So it may sound like almost a repeat, but it really is more specific to the type of housing stock, how it's reviewed, and where that kind of development might occur. So,
any questions for Daryl on that one?
No.
So we'll plug those with those changes into the final draft document that you'll receive. And up next on your reading material will be goals and policies for utilities. And we'll also have the goals and policies for capital facilities. And the capital facilities one, like I said, it's one that of all the elements we look at, scrutinize this one, if you would, and pay particular attention to the elements that are here, because when it comes right down to it, these next two are going to be the ones where you're going to make financial decisions based on the goals and policies that are contained within these. Capital facilities element is going to give you kind of the guidance in the future as to how you spend your money. And as you make those decisions, you'll look back in the comprehensive plan and say, well, this policy supports that, or we can't do that because we really don't have any policies that help us support spending that money. So those are the ones we want to make sure we focus on, and you are have a high comfort level as a council as we move forward with these goals and policies. So you'll get these in your packet for your next study or work session, but I'm going to pass them out now so you have them, but you'll also get them electronically so you can make changes or go in and do whatever you need to do. So I'll pass those out. The first one is the capital facilities, and we'll follow that up with the utilities goals and policies. So we're trying to make this in bite-sized pieces so we don't devote the whole 4 hours in one evening to review these. So So I appreciate your patience as we go through these. I know sometimes it's tedious work, but it is something that at the end will be very important. As the mayor said, this is a 20-year plan and your 20-year vision for the city, and you have an opportunity here to really set the stage for what Othello will become. So thank you for your time. Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you, Darrell.
Thank you.
Okay, 2.03, potential water options review. Larry and Nancy.
Hi, my name is Nancy Mortar. I'm in the wastewater group with Gray and Osborne. I've been in front of you now a couple times. We're here today to talk about water reclamation and reuse, and so hopefully you had a chance to look at some exciting reading in your packets. If anybody else would like, I have extra handouts if anybody else would like one. So in summary, this looks like a long list and a long presentation, but it is meant to be a brief overview of water reclamation and reuse. It's a very in-depth topic, and I could talk a long time about it, but the intention here is to give you just sort of a broad picture of what it is in Washington State. So we're just going to go through some kind of a reminder of what you have for a treatment plant, your current flows and loadings, then what a definition of water reclamation reuse, and then we'll continue to talk about how those water reclamation facility and a water reclamation utility is formed. The cost that would be associated with this if it was something you guys wanted to pursue in the future, and then I'm going to divert back to Larry to talk a little bit about the clean water side of things. So just a brief overview of your treatment plant. It was built in 1955. It's a set of lagoons out, I believe it's Cunningham Road out west. Two 20-acre cells were originally built, and then in 1981 and 1992, you upgraded with some additional lagoons. It's a facultative lagoon process, which essentially just means that the wastewater flows into these huge, like 40, 50-acre ponds, stays there for probably up to 30, 40, if not longer, days, and comes out. You do not aerate those lagoons. The most treatment that you do is you do add disinfection from time to time. But essentially, it's just a lagoon that they flow into. Then you discharge to Owl Creek. And this is important because it is a tributary to Crab Creek, which is one of the more, it's one of the watersheds in Washington, I would say, that has some attention to it. And that's regulated by your NPDES permit. That allows you to discharge into a water of the state. And of course, that's regulated by the Department of Ecology. So this is what you currently have, is a facultative lagoon system that goes into Owl Creek, and it's all regulated by the Department of Ecology. I believe this was a aerial photo we got off of the county website or something. But anyway, you'll see here's Cunningham Road coming in from the city. You have two, these I believe were the original ponds. And then pond 2 and 3 were built later, I believe. But it essentially goes 1A, 1B, 2, 3, 4. This is, I believe, what we consider a polishing pond, so it's at the very end of the stream. And then at this operations building, you have a little bit of, you have a disinfection tank where from time to time, I don't believe it's all year round, I just believe from time to time they add chlorine to the water. And then it's discharged at Owl Creek out here. So a lagoon system is one of the simplest forms of wastewater treatment you can get. It's pretty common in eastern Washington, although somewhat being squeezed out by the fact that you can't get down to the nutrient removal that's being required. As regulations become tougher and tougher, it's more difficult to stick with a lagoon system because you just can't achieve that high of treatment. You currently meet your permit. It's not a problem for you. It's just that those permits are just going to get tighter and tighter with regulations. So that's what you currently have. And just to give you an idea of how much wastewater you treat, we looked at this as part of your, we did that study on total suspended solids, and for the last 5 years, this kind of gives you an idea. On any average day, you guys take in about 1.45 million gallons. That's your average day. The highest month of the year would be 2.18 million gallons, and I believe that happens in the summertime when you have some issues with irrigation and groundwater. These other two items, BOD, or biochemical oxygen demand and total suspended solids, I put those on there because they're in your permit. They're part of the pollutant removal process, and so they measure how much BOD comes into the plant and how much total suspended solids, and then your permit requires you to remove a certain amount. So I took a look at some planning numbers really kind of fast and loose and said, well, where are they going to be in the year 2030? Just based on some quick numbers, population projections, I would say by the year 2030, on an average day, you're going to be taking in 2 MGD. The highest day of the year, you're going to be taking in, or excuse me, the highest month of the year, you're going to be taking in about 3 MGD. So that kind of gives you an idea, you know, sort of where you're at now, where you're going to be going in the future. Of course, as those numbers increase, so do the pollutants that you have to remove increase. Now, if you'll remember, we gave a presentation a few months ago about this total suspended solids, and the city's been working on trying to find out why that number's so high. Typically, this total suspended solids number would be generally in line with this BOD number, one for one, pretty close. But if you'll remember, the last presentation we gave was about why this number is so high, and the city's been working on trying to figure that out. But you'll see down here in the projections, they're really far apart. And so as we move into the future, we definitely want to figure out what that problem is. And the city's been working on that. But I just wanted to point out again that those are should be more one-to-one aligned. If you see 2,300 pounds of BOD, you should see roughly 2,300 pounds of total suspended solids. So water reclamation, this is just the definition I got straight out of the Orange Book, which is kind of like the wastewater engineer's Bible for Washington State. It's a water supply produced from the treatment of domestic sewage. It came about in Washington State in 1992 with the Reclaimed Water Act. Washington State is probably not the most progressive state in reclaimed water. The South is much more progressive, I would say. California probably being the most progressive state in reclaimed water, meaning that their rules and regulations are far more developed and their use of reclaimed water is far more extensive. Essentially, but the idea of reclaimed water is to really treat wastewater, make it into something that's going to be a beneficial use for a community rather than just discharging into a creek in your particular case. So it really came about in 1982. A big change for us in the wastewater industry is they started to develop this reclaimed water rule, but they suspended it. In fact, my company was helping Ecology with that development, but they've suspended it until 2013. And as a result, I wouldn't say that reclaimed water is on hold in Washington State, but it's just, it is in a holding pattern until they decide what to do in 2013. In the back of your packet, council packet, there should have been a sort of a questionnaire on reclaimed water rule. And I included that just because it had some general information. You'll see that they were supposed to adopt that rule in 2011. But I was told that they suspended rulemaking of this kind due to wanting to alleviate, you know, any additional rulemaking on cities when in this type of economy and stuff. So I thought that was kind of an interesting reason why they suspended it. But right now they're not moving forward with any additional reclaimed water rules until 2013. So reclaimed water has four classes. Class A, B, C, and D. And I don't want to bore you with a whole bunch of science behind this, but what's important is, so Class A is the highest, and it requires oxidized, coagulated, filtered, and disinfection. You currently only have partial disinfection out at your treatment plant. You don't perform that all the time. It goes down from there to Class B. You can see at Class B, oxidized and disinfected only. And then the last two are Class C and Class D. And what's important here, Class D is, I believe, generally that's when you'll hear of treatment plants can use effluent within their fence. So at treatment plants that use a lot of spray water, like mechanical plants tend to use spray water as much as 25 to 30,000 gallons a day, they're allowed to use their effluent inside their fence to maybe wash down tanks, that type of thing. What's really most important on this slide, like I said, I don't want to inundate you too much with a bunch of boring science, but you'll see that I've emphasized section number of 23 coliforms per single unit. Now, coliforms are what in wastewater is harmful to humans. We talk about BOD and TSS and ammonia and stuff. That's more harmful to the aquatic life, be it fish, plants, etc. Pathogens or coliforms are what's harmful to you and me in our drinking water. So I emphasize this because you can see as we go down with each class how this gets more and more stringent. 23 and 23 in class A and B. It jumps all the way up to 240 on class C, class D. Those are per single sample. By the time you get to class D, it's a 7-day median. So it's basically like a week sample. Now, again, it doesn't take anybody, you know, with a high science to understand that as you get higher, the quality of that effluent is lower. So from A to D, it's a lower quality at class D. Now, currently, you currently disinfect to a requirement of 400 coliforms per 7-day mean. So you're twice as much as the lowest class of reclaimed water. And as I said, you actually don't even disinfect full-time basis because essentially what it is your water's in that lagoon so long that a lot of the coliforms are already dying off. But your coliform problem comes from the waterfall that's out there. So when you do disinfect, it's often because of the waterfowl. If you didn't have waterfowl, that water sits out there in the lagoons long enough that you don't have a coliform problem. So you're kind of in a different situation there. But you can see, my point here is that there's a huge difference between the quality of water that you're required to produce now than Class A reclaimed water. You do have some neighbors that make Class A reclaimed water, the city of Warden, the city of Ephrata, the city of Quincy, and Royal City have Class A reclaimed water plants. All for different reasons, though. And I would point out that none of those had a stream. I should just say they're all for different regulatory reasons, and they were all built, with the exception of Warden, quite some time ago. This just kind of goes on to further emphasize. So Class A is the highest quality. It must meet drinking water standards, but it's not meant for human consumption. So we have to meet the standards for nitrogen, but it's not meant for human consumption, and human contact isn't permitted. There are some Asian countries that are working, that are really, really water poor, for instance, some of the island countries, that are looking at and are producing reclaimed water into potable bottled water for human consumption. The United States is not even close to that, and that's in a completely different water situation. You have some of those countries over there that buy, literally islands that buy water from other islands and, you know, transport drinking, just to get drinking water. So the water over there is very valuable, and they're moving into making reclaimed water into potable water. We're a long way from that. Class D is the lowest quality, much lower standards, can't be used for the only thing I've ever seen Class D for is maybe wetlands or, like I said, within the treatment plant boundaries itself. And human contact is not permitted, so you can see there's a big difference there. And then B and C fall in the middle. I'm not really sure of any place that makes just Class B or Class C. It either seems like it's Class A, Class D, or just regular wastewater. So a water reclamation utility, so if you make reclaimed water and you want to distribute that and use it, that's another utility. Just like you might have a stormwater utility, a garbage utility, a sewer utility, now you would be forming a water reclamation utility, and so you would set up ordinances and billings and all that type of stuff just as though it were another utility. The things that are really important, though, with this utility are, this is a human safety issue, what that water can be used for. So we did look into this for one of our clients that had a developer that was interested in reclaimed water. And so we did a lot of research in the state, what do other places do? And there's very few reclaimed water plants that actually have a working utility that distributes water. There are some that are getting real close and have a lot of potential. I believe the city of Sequim has some city shop facilities, for instance, that use their reclaimed water for toilet flushing. But in that particular case, the city's their own customer. So they don't have to worry about, they can keep a better eye on cross-connection control. They can keep a better eye on what the exact end product of that is. There might be a few other communities that have had some limited success with using the water out in the community. But as you can imagine, it's a big, big deal to make sure that water is used as intended. One interesting thing to consider would be the liability of interruption of service. For example, if this water is to be used at an industry or, well, even just watering people's lawns, and you have a major interruption of service where your plant doesn't meet Class A standards, and so you either have to maybe, in your case, you might bypass back to the creek, or in your neighbor's cases, they go to these big bypass lagoons where they have to hold the inadequately treated water. So then you'd have to have some thoughts about what's that industry going to do with that water, you know. It's very similar to the electrical companies, and they're, when they have non-interruptible service agreements and those types of things, you can imagine how important that is. Probably the biggest thing for residential use of it is cross-connection control. Within the reclaimed water standards, there's really, really strict guidelines for cross-connection control. For example, your potable water line has to be 10 feet away in the ground, has to be 10 feet away from the reclaimed water pipe. Every single potable water connection has to have a back foot prevention control device. It's purple pipe. There's a special pipe. I shouldn't say special, but a special color of pipe that they use for reclaimed water. Things to consider, for instance, if you're putting this onto people's property, is what's the city's right to go into that property and ensure that there isn't any cross-connection control, or that the property owner is using it as intended. So you can see there's a lot to think about when you're actually distributing this particular water. And then probably one of the biggest thing is the demarcation point between public and private ownership. And a lot of city, for instance, like for sewer or water, a lot of city ordinances are written such that it's the property line. But as I said, in this case, it's a little bit different because it's how much liability the city takes on that person's using the water as intended. We put together some real kind of fast and loose, but with a lot of background. Gray and Osborne has done probably 10 water reclamation facilities in the last 10 years and over 50 treatment plants. And so we have a pretty good handle without having to study your treatment plant. I can give you a pretty good estimate that a conventional wastewater treatment plant for a city your size is going to be about $25 million. And we've discussed this before. When I say conventional wastewater treatment plant, that means it mechanically treats wastewater to meet a higher level than what you currently meet. Right now you put in those big lagoons. Conventional might include an aeration basin where we actually pump air into it. You currently don't purposely remove ammonia. This treatment plant would remove ammonia, BOD, total suspended solids, and even in the case of water reclamation, reduce your nitrogen level. So it's just a much, much higher level than lagoon treatment, and I would say most of your neighbors around here have that type of mechanical treatment plant. And I can tell you that's based on what I did was I looked at our most recently bid treatment plant for a city just about the same size as Othello and very similar characteristics, and that would be the Raymond South Bend communities over on the west side. They built a facility recently that would almost be your same size for 2030 in 2010 dollars for about $23 million. And they had a little bit of differences, but that was kind of the model I used for your coming up with that estimate. Now, if you were to go to reclaimed water, it's an additional cost of $5 to $7 million. So regular conventional treatment's gonna cost $25 million. To go to reclaimed water, $5 to $7 million. It might ask, well, what's the biggest differences? Well, denitrification is required, and that's just a fancy word for saying, again, a higher level of treatment. Conventional wastewater treatment often doesn't have to reduce your total nitrogen number. Because we have to meet groundwater standards, you have to remove nitrogen from your wastewater. So that's one thing that just adds cost to the treatment plant. Flocculation and coagulation, it's just another part of the process to help remove suspended solids out of the wastewater. Filtration goes along with that, and a higher level of disinfection. I showed you those disinfection numbers because those are the most important. That is what targets the pathogens that are harmful to humans. Really, really high level of disinfection. These disinfection systems that are put in water reclamation facilities now, you have to run tests that are upwards of $100,000. When the plant's all up and running, they bring in testing companies that dose the water with viruses and all kinds of nasty bacteria, and then they test it to make sure they can actually disinfect to that standard. With a conventional wastewater treatment plant, we don't have to go to those standards. It's much less expensive. And then there's the most cost is a higher level of reliability and redundancy, and that kind of goes just, again, back to there's double of everything in a water reclamation plan. If you have one computer, you have two in a water reclamation plan. If you have your requirements for aeration double. I mean, everything is just more complicated because of what you're dealing with. If it's Class A water and it's meant for a human to walk it up and touch it, it has to reliably meet those Class A standards. So I would estimate, if I had to choose what it would cost for you guys to put in a water reclamation facility, it's probably right around $32 million in 2012 dollars. Again, that's based on my experience, my company's experience. We've built quite a few water reclamation facilities, and we know the difference between a conventional treatment plant and a reclamation facility. We ran some numbers on distribution system. Now, I don't want to scare you too much with this $60 million, but what that would be is if you wanted to put reclaimed water to every house in Othello or every business and use it for toilet flushing or irrigation, that's what you're looking at. If you were just to provide it to industries, and all we did was run a duplicate pipe cost, you're looking at about $7 million. And so that kind of gives you an idea of what it takes to get into the reclaimed water business. There's a whole lot of other regulatory type stuff that goes with that as well. So So Eamon asked if there were any special funding for water reclamation facilities. And when water reclamation first came out in the 90s, there was. I believe some of your neighbors participated in what they called demonstration projects. And, you know, because they were on the front of the curve, you know, they got some money from ecology to do some special things. There's no special funding for water reclamation anymore. The funding is just your regular old run-of-the-mill stuff that you've probably heard of these programs in any of your talks regarding utilities. Ecology provides some funding, CDBG, USDA rural development, CURB, and of course there's lots of loan programs out there. All this funding is really competitive, but there's nothing special for water reclamation. You're kind of thrown in with everybody else. Ecology does have a program that's called Green Project Reserved, and what that is Congress has stated that a certain amount of the money that comes down from the federal government has to be dedicated to green projects. And it's very specific. I actually called Ecology to ask if that Green Project Reserve was, there's an element in that part of the bill that talks about water efficiency. And when I asked if that was implied to be water reclamation, they were kind of, not really. And he kind of went into a long diatribe that water reclamation takes a lot of energy and it takes a lot of it's not necessarily green in their minds, and you have to, and if it is green, if it does prove that it takes less energy to make and that it really is a benefit to the in terms of conserving water, they would only pay for those portions that make water reclamation, the $7 million, they wouldn't pay for the $25 million. So it's a very limited program, but I did want to mention it because it's kind of the buzzword around ecology now is this Green Project Reserve stuff. What it's really targeted for is these communities that can make gas in their digesters and generate electricity and that type of thing, which are the larger communities, you know, your Pascos, Kennewicks, Yakimas, those types of communities. Larry's going to talk about water system planning because that's clean water, and I don't do clean water. And then we can answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Good evening. We wanted to touch briefly on what the clean water side of it means. I know the city's been planning for a couple of years now for a new well, and there's been money set aside for it. Been actively looking for property, and we wanted to touch on why the city would need a new well at this time. If you recall, last year we assisted the city with completing its update to the water system plan that's been approved by Department of Health. And in it, we refer back to a number of state requirements for figuring out source capacity and reliability within the water system. And there's a particular WAC, Washington Administrative Code, that requires source capacity to be sufficient to provide a reliable supply of water equal to or exceeding the city's maximum day demand at all times. Basically, what it means is you need to be able to produce as much water as you have customers that are requiring it. And maximum day demand is defined as the maximum amount of water pumped from the city's wells in a 24-hour period. And that's a key term, MDD, for Department of Health in looking at just how much water the city can produce. We had a couple of tables in the water system plan. Too far. You can tell she's the computer savvy one. Sorry. Okay. This is a table that's in the water system plan. It's one of the ones that Department of Health looks at quite closely. Othello's a bit unique with the food processors, the large industries that we have that a lot of communities don't have. And we look at MDD, max day demand, in comparison to source capacity. And max day demand is the amount of water that all of the city's customers will need at any given time. Source capacity is the amount of water the city can pump. That's why all of the numbers are the same, because you add up the gallons per minute that each well can produce at any given time. And then basically you do math. Plus or minus is a comparison of, do you have any extra water or do you need water? Plus being you have extra water. So you can see in 2010 and 2016, when the industries are not using city water, we have a surplus. By the year 2030, we're estimating if growth continues the way it's projected, we'll have a deficit. However, when industries are using water, and we're talking maximum demands here, we're deficient at this point, which means the city should look at an additional water source. Hence, in the water system plan, we're recommending the drilling and equipping of the new well number 9. That, in a real brief summary, is where the water system is in comparison to the sewer system as far as a new water source. And with that, if you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
I guess I'll start out. So the water coming out of our plant treatment plant right now cannot be used for irrigation purposes? For like a farmer downstream wanted to purchase our water
to irrigate his crops? Now, once you put it in the stream, it's a different story. If you developed a spray field yourself, that's a type of treatment, but could a farmer downstream use your wastewater? Yeah, once it goes into the stream, it's then a water of the state. So yes, he can use it for irrigation downstream. Could you develop a spray field yourself locally and give it to a farmer to spray? Yes. It's a whole nother type of animal, but it can only go on certain crops. It has to have a crop management plan. It has to have quite a bit more to it. One of the interesting tables that was in the packet that I find interesting to really ask questions about what you can and can't do with reclaimed water is in the back here. For instance, it'll say irrigation of non-food crops. Pretty much any class of water, reclaimed water, can be used for irrigation of non-food crops, but it changes once you get to food crops or root crops, those types of things. So this is kind of a handy table in terms of what it can be used for and what it can't be used for. But in terms of your current treatment plant, no, you're not allowed to sell it to a farmer directly. You could develop a spray field. Once it goes into the creek, though, it becomes waters of the state. That's why you have to meet their standards, is because you're putting it into the waters of the state. Interestingly enough, if you take that water back out of that stream, you have to do a mitigation of, well, now you've removed water from the stream, and you would have to do a look at how that affects other water right holders and stuff. So
even though it was yours to begin with.
Even though it was yours to begin with. You've been putting it into the stream since 1955, probably before then. So if you were to remove that from the stream now, you would have to take a look at how you're affecting other water right holders. That's just kind of another whole other animal.
That was my next question. So
The city of George does that right now as far as providing water to a farmer for irrigation on a spray field. And they have a lagoon system much smaller than Othello's, but they do basically the same thing.
But because we've been putting our water in the stream so long, we can't really get away with doing that very easily. Selling our water to a farmer to irrigate.
Yeah,
they look at it in the permitting cycle. We looked into doing it at one point in time, and there's all kinds of regulations. You know, like she said, with the food crops, and you know, it has to be placed before the plants are, you know, there's any actual viable food, or it has to be on there, and then nobody can go on it for so long, or they can't let in cattle on it, and it's
like 1,000-foot setbacks all around the field. It's just quite a bit more involved. And think of it this way: you can only irrigate 6 months out of the year. So what do you do with the water the other 6 months? Well, you in your particular case, I guess you might be able to go back to a creek. In George's case, they have to store for 6 months out of the year. Warden had a spray field at one time.
You actually have to go through a whole permitting process just for that. So in that permitting process is probably where you would address the fact that you're taking the water out of the creek and putting it on a field. And it wouldn't be, you wouldn't be like diverting your water the whole time. It'd be sporadic. So you're not completely taking it out of the creek.
But you got the people down Crab Creek that use that.
But there's a lot of water
all the way down the creek.
There's a lot of water in the Owl Creek,
yeah,
as it is.
They'd still say, well, you're taking some water.
You would still have to go through the exercise to prove or disprove whether you're affecting somebody else.
Yeah. And like I said, you have to go through an entire permitting process just in order to do that kind of application with ecology, and you have to go through the whole public process and da 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 da. So it would all be addressed in that, but it's a big process because we looked at it at one point.
Sounds like we're talking pie in the sky here a little bit. Yeah. You know, so if you're going to do that, why don't you put a pump down on a river and a big pipe run it up Crab Creek and make it a tri-county clean water system, pull it up here, run it into Othello, buy it off to Warden and Connell and Royal City, and you know, and that's where everybody gets their drinking water. You get the whole thing.
One thing you have to keep in mind when you hear that the water's going into the creek and it's going downstream and people are using it downstream, you got to also remember that the water that we're putting into the creek is cleaner than the water in the creek, because we do monitor the water upstream and downstream, and it is cleaner. Other than our waterfowl problem, it's hysterical because about this time of year, when there's no open water and when everything's frozen, the polishing pond, which was that very last pond on the chain, the water comes down and it splits. It goes into the two big ponds, and then it goes in, then it's brought back together and it goes through the last three ponds in sequence. That last pond is kind of your real cleaning up pond. And in the wintertime, that thing will be completely black with birds, ducks. You know, every duck from California to Canada, they just follow the wastewater chain.
Yeah.
And yeah, kind of makes me wonder when my husband goes hunting. but that's what they do, because the water is warm, it always stays open, and with lagoons you really have no defense against that, and you've got 10,000 ducks sitting on a pond doing their business, and it just sends your fecal coliforms through the roof.
Ken?
Just thinking about the comment of taking that water back out of the creek, but what you could do is say in the future you could maintain that same flow that you've got in that creek right now, and any additional from say date 2013 or whatever, any of that we could come back and do our other thing, and then you wouldn't have to go through all of that process of taking your water back that you've already put into that creek. So you could do it that way too. Necessarily have to go through all that process.
Because to me, water is a very viable product. It's worth money.
Definitely.
You know what I mean? And we live in the desert. So it just seems to me there should be a way, whether a farmer, we digs a pipe to his place and starts using, I don't know. I'm green in this, so I have no idea. But, you know, that there would be some way we could, you know, the city could
profit from that money somehow, and a farmer gets a profit from it by putting in new circles or whatever it is, and whether it's alfalfa or something that's not food going to humans, you know, whether it's alfalfa or something like that that he's using for cattle feed or whatever, that there would be a way that the city could profit from that instead of just letting that disappear. I don't know. This is...
Well, as I mentioned, other states are much more progressive with this. For example, in California, they put reclaimed water into the Bureau canals. Well, I shouldn't say Bureau canals. I'm not sure what canals they are, but irrigation canals. And they reuse that in irrigation. Your neighbor, Warden, has a major canal that runs right by the treatment plant, and they are not allowed to discharge their Class A reclaimed water into that canal. So your comment about making water really viable and, you know, how can it be a product for a city, if one state can do it, another state should be able to do it. It's a matter of how the regulations are set up and how valuable water is in that state. Other states that are really successful with it are Texas. So, yes, there's a lot of states that do a lot more with it in Washington State, and we're just not quite there yet.
We have that similar situation right here. We've got wastewater that comes out of our plants out here. It's pumped 6-7 miles east of here and used. So that diverts that water and goes that way rather than running into the creek.
Yeah, but you also have to remember that the wastewater coming out of the plants is potato water. There's no fecals. There's no anything harmful to humans. And it's going out and it's going into its own treatment or holding system, and then it goes out on the fields. And I'm not even sure, correct me if I'm wrong, but I, you know, when we were looking at going through that process of getting the permit to with a farmer, we were having to look around to see if there was even anybody that was interested. And I don't think you can, it's a monetary thing. It's just if you can find somebody that wants to put it on their field.
Well, the problem is they have to, you know, put it on an agronomic rate. They have to have some studies.
Well, and there's all those restrictions that if it goes on, it has to be there and nobody can touch it for so many days.
It has to be alfalfa, or it has to be wheat, or it has to be corn, whatever the crop management guy says. And so that's where you kind of get into that.
And there's a huge perception issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another community up in the basin that has a water reclamation facility and also has a separate industrial waste stream similar to Othello will not be allowed to discharge the effluent from that industrial waste stream after the year 2015 into the Bureau Canal that's right next to the plant, even though it's just agricultural effluent, potatoes, other crops, because it's a perception issue. And the Bureau says no, even though it's cleaner than the water that's in there now. And until water gets to be so expensive that there are no other options, like the small islands that Nancy was talking about, I don't know if we're going to see ecology and health, state departments doing anything to assist the communities to reclaim or reuse.
Well, and you also have to remember that ecology, basically, the majority of it is based out of Olympia, even though we've got the offices around the state. And that side of the mountains doesn't have an issue with water per se.
Good point.
So their regulations are really going to be geared towards what's going on over there, not over here.
So basically you're saying at the moment in the state of Washington, forget it, huh?
For now. It could be in health, I don't think, to the point where, at least they weren't a year or so ago, of seriously considering what to do with reclaimed water and reuse water and recharging it. We've sat in Spokane meetings both with health and ecology with two different clients at two different times, trying to persuade them to follow the state laws that are set up for recharge. And one meeting, the first half hour was spent between ecology and health deciding who was going to be in charge of the meeting. The second half hour was spent on what they were going to call what we were trying to do. It's frustrating to try and get the regulators to assist the communities to be good stewards of water.
Uh-huh. Then you've got another thing called the budget. I think it's going to hold it back for several years.
Good point, Ken.
About the biggest project I ever saw that came across, you know, that I saw that was an example of what they were doing with reclaimed water was over on the other side of the mountains, and it was like a wetland. basically. And it was contained in an area, and but there were signs, you had to post signs everywhere and everything. It was just, and they had the pipes and everything out where people could see it, and they had signs everywhere, and but you couldn't go and touch the water, you couldn't do anything.
Because we're going to spend the $25 million no matter what. Eventually.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to make us do it. That's why we're saving money right now. So I'm just thinking, how in the heck can we make some money out of this thing in the end? I don't know. To help pay for this thing. So, you know.
Well, in some ways, we've had a couple clients in a similar situation that were pushed by regulatory to make a move on wastewater. And they chose to do Class A reclaimed water because they felt like if they were going to do a mechanical plant, they were going to go all the way with it. And
maybe.
It was probably less regulatory restrictive when they decided to do it than it is now. We've had clients that had that choice between a spray field and a Class A reclaimed water plant, and the spray field was less money, but they decided to go with Class A reclaimed water plant because they just figured, well, they had to put that much money into it, they might as well go all the way. So we have had some clients that sort of took the approach of, you know, regulations are not going to get relaxed. So.
Yeah, well, and you're just kind of banking that maybe someday in the future they'll change the rules. Oops.
Any other questions? Well, thank you, Larry and Nancy.
Save the money.
This was enlightening. Darn it.
Don't give up hope.
Water's worth something, so it'd sure be nice to get something out of it.
But, let us know when you figure that out.
Yeah. Okay, 2.04, monthly investment report. Mike?
Good evening, Mr. Mayor and Council. This is our monthly investment report. I just wanted to go through a few things. And what I'm actually trying to do is I'm trying to educate you on where we stand on a monthly basis in terms of our finances, in terms of what's available and in investments in cash. And the reason I want to do that is that as you go through the budget process, those numbers should stick out in your mind, because once again, I helped a city who thought they had somebody had stolen $1 million, when in fact the budget process kind of cheated them out of money. It told them they had more money than they really had, and they were spending money they didn't have, and a year later thought that somebody had stolen $1 million from them. And I want to, I'm not, you know, this is actually my last year here at the city. So I'm preparing you. I want you to know what's going on a monthly basis. And then when you get into the budget process, you should have a good feeling about where you're at and when you're making financial decisions. And so that's really the key to what I'm doing here right now. I'm going to bring up a couple of reports. And this is a report that I started, and I know you've seen it. We have two areas where we invest. One is this one is the local government investment pool. It's owned and run by the state of Washington. So we never have to worry about it being legal. It doesn't have quite the return as our other one does, but it's very liquid. If I need money tomorrow and I call them before 10 o'clock, I could have them transfer $2 million into my checking account that same day. So this is very liquid. And so that's very appealing. So I have, as you can see, at the end of the year, we had about $4.3 million in the state investment pool. The return was not very good. And if you look over to the right-hand column and see the interest rate, it almost makes you shudder to think you got $4.2 million invested, and for a month you're only making $476 on it. That's almost ludicrous. I mean, just a few years ago, that number would have been about $20,000 a month. So that's kind of where we're at in this economy. This is the Bank of America investment portfolio. We've talked about this over the past year because of some
tried to divest ourselves of some investments that weren't allowed by state law. And so we see some months where our earnings were very high, when in fact we were selling off some investments and making money off of them to become legal. You see a month in November where you have a negative number, and that is, there's no such thing as really as a negative earnings. What happened is our portfolio lost value that month. So we kind of took it on the chin. But as you can see for the year, almost $187,000 in earnings, and pretty much almost the same amount of money that's in the state investment pool. So, but we did lose those investments. I mean, we divested ourselves of those investments that were giving us a very high return. And of course, one of the reasons we had the high return was that they just are not allowed by state law because they're too risky. Okay, so that's kind of where we stand there. I want to show you a report. I'm not going to go through every line of this or anything else, but our bias accounting system runs this report. Okay, and on the last page of the report, right here, in the last two right-hand columns, it shows investment balance, and it shows our cash balance, and then so the numbers that I showed you on the investment side will total that $8.977 million. Okay, so what I'm telling you is equal to what our accounting system. And then I'm going to show you another report that I put in here. And it's going to look kind of wacky because it's the only way to get it to run. This comes from U.S. Trust, which is a subsidiary of Bank of America, and this is where our investment portfolio is. I take this every month, and I just have to do this math right here. If everybody wants to turn sideways,
right click and hit rotate clockwise.
Do what now?
Right click your mouse, hit rotate clockwise. It'll turn it around.
Rotate the
right click.
Okay, right click.
You highlight the box.
Yeah, you highlight
it.
Just right click wherever. Outside of that box.
Oh, okay. Right click.
On the page.
It's not that important. All I'm really trying to show you is where I got my numbers. So, and then every month I'll be giving these reports to you. You won't have to read them sideways. This is the state investment pool. This is a statement we get from them every month. And so it would equal what our bias system says and everything else I'm doing. So that every month you have the assurance that the numbers you're getting are accurate numbers. And I do another monthly report on the finance side. And in that report, it gives the fund balance of every fund in the city. So that's just a picture of that. Are there any questions?
No? Okay. Well, thank you, Mike. Does the council need to take a 5-minute break? Or are we okay still? Everybody okay?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll keep rolling now. What's that? Transportation Benefit District Discussion 2.05. Amen.
Well, we're going to learn a new term tonight. And I'm going to use the red pointer on this screen. I think most of you can see it on this side. The new term tonight is called a Transportation Benefit District, or a TBD. And the definition of that, and I'll read it, a transportation benefit district are quasi-municipal corporations and independent taxing districts created for the sole purpose of acquiring, constructing, improving, providing, and funding transportation improvements within the district. So knowing what it is, why are we looking at a transportation improvement district in the city of Othello? Well, we used to get a lot of funding from the state. One was a motor vehicle excise tax, MVET, as we used to call it. We don't get that anymore. $0. We used to get, well, I can't remember how much. Mike and I talked about it today, and it went away before Mike even came to the city. So he didn't know. So it's been several years ago. We used to get some other funding from the state that would allow us to use for our street improvements. We don't get that anymore. So this is a vehicle that allows the city to create a transportation benefit district to allow us to recover funding for the city. If you couple the loss of funding with the cost of street improvements today, for example, in, I think it was 03 or 04, I think it was 04, we created a 9-year transportation and improvement plan for the city. In that plan, we budgeted $200,000 a year for neighborhood street improvements. That $200,000 a year at that time, with the price of oil, we could do 44 blocks of street improvements. Today, with that same $200,000, we can do 14 blocks. So we've lost money and increased our costs to do street improvements. So the state government has given you the authority to create a transportation improvement district. How is it created? You, the city council, creates it. Basically, it is you as a city council. You are the transportation benefit district board. You would have to meet separately than a council would meet. You would have to do your separate budget. You would have to pay the city for doing the improvements, but that's part of the process. There are two things in your packet. One is an ordinance, or actually three. One, an ordinance that creates it. One is an ordinance that creates the amount. Now, you as a city council can, as a TBD, authorize or levy a tax on the license tabs up to $20 per license tab. If you want to go above $20, you have to go out for a vote of the people. Now, there is some state legislation, Ken and I were talking about it today, and thank you, Ken, pending that may increase that from $20 to $40. That hasn't happened yet. So what does that mean financially? What are the financial impacts to the city of Othello? Well, initially, I did some rough calculations, and in your initial agenda memo, you'll see $70,000. Well, that's actually incorrect. It's $129,000 annually, and that's pretty close based on the formula. And you all have a copy of the formula. It says TBD on the top in red. That's the calculations that Mike did that arose that gave us a number of $129,000. Half year is $64,000, which if you implement and follow the process, which is you have to conduct a public hearing, you have to pass an ordinance, you have to give notice to the public, you can recover in this year about $64,000. These funds must be identified for street improvements only. They cannot be used for the water treatment plant. They can't go in the general fund or anything like that. Street improvements only. Now remember, if I can find my number, general fund, our current general fund, contributes to the street fund $460,000 a year. So if you create a transportation benefit district, you're also helping the general fund, because the general fund does not have to support the transfer or the street fund by whatever amount we collect each year, about $129,000. So the question tonight, the benefits, let me kind of identify those. It creates a funding mechanism, and this is on your agenda memo. Revenues from $20 vehicle license fees significantly reduces the annual general fund, which we just talked about. Subsidy of the street maintenance operating expenses. It funds from the TBD dedicated to maintain, preserve, and or construct City of Othello transportation infrastructure. It assists in maintaining current levels of service. It's the state, the number one priority of the state transportation plan is to maintain the existing infrastructure and the investment we have in that. Not to build new, but to maintain what we already have. And is a flat rate license fee and will not increase unless there's a vote of the people. Again, anything above right now, anything above $20 has to go to a vote of the people. So we talked about what is a TBD, how it's created and why, some of the powers, the financial impacts to the city, and we talked about the benefits of creating a TBD. If you've been reading the local newspapers, some of the surrounding cities have already done this. Royal City, Soap Lake, Ephrata, I think George and Moses Lake also have done it. The question to the council, because of the process, remember, we have to go through a process, a public hearing process, notification to the public. If you want to continue or look at this further, we as staff and the mayor and I have talked about this extensively. We need to know from you if you want to move this forward or not. It doesn't mean we're going to create a fee tonight. It just means you want the public to be notified. You want a public hearing in front of the public, and then you'll look at and consider creating a TBD. Any questions?
I guess one of the things I would like to see the city do that, because you're taxing the people, that's vehicles that are using our streets, you know what I mean? So I think it's a very fair tax as far as that is, and what it's going to do for us. Like Eamon said, we've lost a lot of tax over the years. We've seen a lot of stuff disappear. And, you know, I think it's fairly fair. $20 is very reasonable in my eyes, but might not be in somebody else's. So does the council want to continue looking at this?
Yes.
Over here?
Yep. Yes.
We should.
Yes? Okay. Guess we'll continue looking at it, and you can start moving forward, and we'll see where we end up at the end, I guess, Eamon.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Committee reports. Do we have any committees?
I've got one quick little thing here.
Committee report?
Ten and eight doesn't see you.
Okay.
I guess that's under committee.
Sure.
Committee of one. I guess it'd be under the legislative committee or whatever you want to call it. I did go over to Olympia. As a matter of fact, I stayed over there. I just got back into the country, and I decided to stay over there rather than drive back and forth with the weather the way it was. So I stayed an extra week over on the west side, and I went to Olympia and went to AWC conference that they had over there in Olympia. It was very interesting. A lot of issues, a lot of things. Of course, the big issue is the $2 billion budget that they're playing with or toying with, whatever you want to call it. They've got a lot of things on the book, what they're trying to do and trying to generate more revenue and trying to make some cuts, and they're running out of places to make cuts. So that's probably the basic idea of what's going on. Mark Schessler happened to sit on one of the panels for one of the conference meetings there, and he told us the way it is here in Eastern Washington. As most of us know, this particular area. The others, there was four. They kind of picked each area of the state, and basically we're all in the same boat. We're trying to figure out a way to make things turn around and have the state help us out a little bit more on every issue. It's all trickling right back down to the cities and the counties trying to make up this difference. The governor was there. She talked on her issues and what she's trying to get the legislative to do. She's got some proposals. Whether they'll happen or not, this is her last year, so maybe she's just trying to implant some of these things that'll happen in the future. This is supposed to be a short session. Whether it will be or not, I don't know. They've got some issues that they're looking at. We're talking about this funding of what we're doing here, and they did mention that they were possibly trying to get this up to $40 instead of $20. So that's going to help a little bit. Every since, I shouldn't put a name on it, but I'll say, every since some of these initiatives that's been put out and the voters vote on them, they may look good on paper, they may look good to an individual, but when you go back to a city or a community and you start seeing things that don't happen anymore, you wonder why. There's no money there. There's no money to get any of this done. Our 1% property tax, that's part of the problem. It's set. You can't do anything different with it. Our vehicle license, sure, maybe it was too high, maybe it was out of proportion. People drive trucks, they bitch about the tonnage. There's a lot of things that goes on. But somebody's got to pay for these roads. They're being tore all two pieces, and I'm not picking on trucks or anything. It's just the whole thing, the way it's going, it's not fun to drive. So they're proposing some different ideas for revenue. One that I know is going to hit the fan, they're talking about a dollar and a half to maybe even a little more per barrel of oil that comes into this country or in the state of Washington, or is produced from our refineries, to see if they can generate some revenue out of that. Of course, it's like a tax to your gas or whatever, but it's got, something's got to give. Your electric cars don't pay any gas tax. What do you do? Some way, they're still running up and down the roads. You're going to, more and more of them. So that is an issue. So they're talking about proposing a tax on that. Something like $100 a year or something. It's not much, but it's, you figure overall your gas tax, well, it all fits in the picture. So it's not just totally cut. Somewhere, you got to have to increase somewhere, and I think that's what the whole legislature was looking at, trying to get this all put together. And like I say, it was pretty interesting. We had a good meeting. I talked to a few of the legislators, and overall, I think there's hope out there. I think that we're not dead in the water yet, and I think that things are starting to turn around as far as the revenue and the way the budget looks. It looks like there may even possibly be some funding, like in our Public Works Trust Fund again. They're trying to come up with an idea to make that happen. There's some money coming from the federal government that'll trickle down to different areas, and I think that'll help us. Our percentage will be pretty small, but at least it'll be something. So that's kind of some of the things I got out of what went on over there. It was a worthwhile conference.
Thank you for going for us, Ken. We appreciate that. Any other committee reports?
Yeah, the beautification committee met with the, and the members on the council met with the architect last Monday, and I guess we're going to have some plans here within a month of hopefully what our streets would possibly look like in the future. And we had some really good ideals there and a good direction.
The contract for that should be at the council meeting on the 13th.
Okay. Any other committee reports? Thank you, Ken. Unfinished business? New business?
I got something on new business. Now that our short winter has come and gone in the 1 week that we had it, all the snow is starting to melt. And I walked down my block and noticed something sticking out all over the place. This was just in a four-house area. It's an advertisement that is thrown out from a paper. Like I said, that was just in a four-house area. Not to mention, when the snow was on the ground, what it does to a snowblower when you go through one after a couple hours trying to dig it out. There's got to be something that we could do to stop that, because to me it's no more different than littering, because these are getting through on the streets, they're getting through on the sidewalks, they're getting through on the lawns. Residents are not picking them up, and the beautification committee is doing a wonderful job around town to help stop stuff like this. And I think there's an ordinance, or we need to do something to stop this.
I know that it's they're not at the request of the people that they're putting these in the yards, and I got so sick of having them on my yard that I called them up and told them not to, they better not put any more on mine, and they haven't. They've been pretty good about that, but.
Is this something you want us to look into? To educate us on this?
Drive down the street and throw them out. It used to be when we got that, you know, the midweek thing, kid that I know brought it around. His mother drove him around and he took it up and put it on a porch. And now, whoever's doing it, the same thing, it just goes out the door and it lands sometime on the driveway, sometime someplace else, somewhere else. How many people here had a paper route? Anybody have a paper route? Yeah. When I had my paper route, paper better be on the front porch 6 o'clock in the morning. And it wasn't, you got called. About the third time your mother got called, 6:15 in the morning, and because you didn't deliver your paper, you were in trouble. But, you know, we used to get the paper all the time here, Tri-City Herald and the Spokane paper, and they were delivered and put on the front porch. Now you don't even get Spokane paper, and the other one comes out there on the driveway. And my next door neighbor, they just throw it out on the lawn. That's where it is, it's just trashy looking.
Yeah, especially this time of year when you don't know if it's going to rain or snow. By the time you get home, they're rained on, they're wet, they're soggy, snowed on, covered under the snow.
If you're not paying any attention to it, you drive over them and you pull in your rifle.
If you're not, they're driven that way. Like I said, I just collected all those in front of four homes in our neighborhood.
I don't know what you do about it.
Well, we'll look into it and give you a report back, and then we can move from there. So, not sure what is all there that we can do, but I guess we can find out. So, that'll work. Okay.
I got one more thing under new business while you're talking about that. Have we had an influx of graffiti going on in town lately? I guess I could address our chief, but. I noticed
an influx, no, but we have had graffiti after our month of not having any. It's no more than usual. It's not a rampant thing right now. We've caught one adult and one juvenile for that last round. So
good.
That's probably.
Yeah, I just was curious because maybe they just moved locations, huh?
Pardon me?
I said maybe they just moved to a different location, huh?
I'm sorry.
No, and their graffiti, I said maybe they just moved to a different location of building. From this building to that building instead.
Oh, sure.
Any other new business? Okay, Mayor's announcements. Mayor Luncheon is Wednesday, February 8th at noon at the Othello Senior Center, and everybody's invited. The Sandhill Crane Festival is March 23rd, 24th, and 25th this year, and brochures are due to be mailed the weekend of February 11th. So to get your tickets, please contact Sandhill Crane Festival at 866-726-3445. And the Chamber Banquet is in the high school corridor on Friday, February 24th at 6. So hope to see everybody there when that comes. And any other announcements before we go into executive session? Okay, then the council will now adjourn into executive session pursuant of RCW 42.30.110, parentheses 1, parentheses B, to consider the selection of a site or acquisition of real estate by lease or purchase. The executive session is expected to last 30 minutes. No action will be taken during the executive session. So, Eamon, I think you're just the one we need in here.
And Mayor, can we ask Mike to stay also?
Oh, okay. Mike, would you stay, please? Okay. Is that what you're doing?